Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the May 4th, 2015 edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my guest today is the brilliant Nicholas Kahlestrom, and we're going to be discussing his new book, Breaking the Spell, Holocaust, Myth and Reality. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Well, it's a great privilege to be on your Heretics Hour, Caroline.
Well, it's a great privilege for me to have you here, and I hope we're going to have a great show, because I know you've already been on several radio shows, and because your book's been out, what, for a couple of months now?
Yeah, a few months, yeah. It is selling well, and Grandma Rudolph says he's very pleased to have a revisionist book that is doing well, and it's reaching a different kind of market than usual revisionist books. So I'm quite.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Tell us more about that. What is it? How is it reaching different markets? And then we'll have to discuss about your book why that would be so.
Well, I've just reviews it's got, like Occidental Observer, that got a nice review in that magazine, and different people have posted, because I'm sort of known a bit in conspiracy theory world. See, I do stuff on modern conspiracy theory, and that is generally rather sort of left-wing. Left-wing types do get involved with conspiracy theory, and what we'd call revisionism is much more traditionally right-wing, and I'm trying to, I'm concerned to develop an approach to this subject that is basically not political. It's a search for what happened in World War II in the past, and this search cannot be labelled with any political label put on it, which is what people always try to do. So I feel that it is getting through to some more general readership. I mean, it's not like there's any printed media will review it. I mean, I think from that point of view, it's beyond the pale, you know. There's no newspaper or journal in print that will review it. But it is getting nice comments on the web.
Well, yes, and of course, your previous book that you alluded to was, I think, titled 7-7.
Terror on the Tube, yes.
Tube, that's right.
About who did the London bombings.
And that came out in 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've been quite well known since then. And since then, you started looking more into Holocaust, is that right?
Well, that was going on a bit the same time as I was doing that last book, which people found rather confusing. But I got chucked out of my college in 2008 because of some things I'd written about some residual cyanide in the walls of German labour camps. And that suddenly was an involuntary turning point in my life, because everybody ethically damned me then, and being thrown out of my college. Suddenly, I'd been a science historian, and I couldn't be this any longer, because no academic journal would touch my stuff. So the idea was that I'd be finished, that when you're rejected by the powers that be and accused of being a Nazi, you know, a Holocaust denier, an anti-Semite, when you get those labels hurled at you, that you don't come back again. You can't ever get employed again. You can't ever get a publisher or anything. So that's usually regarded as some irreversible ruin. Partly that I am quite sort of elderly, and so in a sense I'm a pensioner, and in a sense I'm not that bothered at being unemployable. But I feel I have sort of recovered a bit from that.
Well, right. I was going to just ask you, because I know you write about this in a very interesting way in your book. It's fascinating to read about it. It's a big story in itself, how they stop people from looking into this. And so you were in good standing in the academic world, in the academy, and just overnight, because of one paper that I guess the paper did get published, right?
Well, it was on CODOR. It's actually two or three papers I published in CODOR on the subject of, you know, chemical analysis, basically, of Leuchten and Gamma Rudolph. And I thought the 20th anniversary of Fred Leuchten's work was coming up, and this might be, you know, something significant. And it turned out that 20th anniversary was me being thrown out of my college.
So if you had just maybe, you just went a little too far, and I suppose associating yourself with the CODOR committee on open debate on the Holocaust was too much for them, huh?
It was, yeah. There was no discussion at all, no debates. I couldn't talk with anyone about it. I'd been connected with the college for 15 years, mm-hmm. and I was a member of staff, but suddenly I was told that I was thrown out, and the newspapers were damning me, and blogs were griping at me, and it was, obviously it was a very difficult period, yeah. But my feeling is that the climate of opinion has changed now, that people are willing to talk about the subject and are grateful for being able to talk about it. Because we've been told for so long that we're not allowed to talk about it, and we just have to believe it. And I think more and more people are coming to realise, actually, we would like to be able to talk about it, you know.
Well, what about your friends in the academic world that felt they had to distance themselves from you immediately without even talking to you about it? Have any of them come back round, or has any of that lightened up or changed?
No, I don't think so. I think that was very traumatic. I lost whatever friends I got in academia and astronomical world. I was a historian of astronomy. So that's kind of gone suddenly. In fact, there was quite a funny sequel to this, Caroline, that I was a big encyclopedia was reviewed in an American history of science journal called ISIS, the most prestigious journal, and I'd got a biography in it. I'd done a biography of several, including Isaac Newton, and so this review of the book spent half the review damning me and saying how awful it was that they'd included me in it, and the whole thing should be pulped, taken back to publisher and pulped, because it got me in it. And this was some Jew reviewing it, called Swerdler, right? Mm-hmm. And he thought he could just demand that this whole very prestigious encyclopedia was taken back and pulped. And as it happened, the editor resisted that. And then my friend Jim Fetzer, who, by the way, did a lot helping me to recover from the ethically damned condition I was in. He really was prepared, keen on doing dialogue and discussions with me. Mm-hmm. I think that helped a lot, good old Jim. And he and I wrote to all of the staff, members of staff of the American Society of History and Science, deploring this and saying that it wasn't the right way to behave. And not a single one of them replied. So I think there's considerable academic timidity.
Yeah, I can say considerable. Right, yeah. They're scared to death. They know they can't even touch it. Now, we'll get into that. Yeah, Jim Fetzer wrote a very good introduction to your book.
Right.
I was impressed by it, and I thought it set just the right tone.
Well, exactly. I mean, a professor of logic go through some of the central issues is really quite something, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that helps to avoid having the book dismissed as far right or, you know, because what they're trying to say is like a spell. It is a spell. The spell they cast is saying anyone who believes this is secretly a Nazi, you know, secretly far right. And that's like a spell. And I started off trying to believe in science and rational argument. And look, we've got measurements of cyanide here and cyanide and measurements there. And more you come to realise that this, especially over the years when I was chucked out, Caroline, it's like there's some enchantment that everyone's under.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that one of the things I liked right off the bat was the title, Breaking the Spell. I thought it was quite brilliant of you to use that title. And, you know, I like that phrase. I used it myself between a year or 2 years ago, something like that, in an article, mm-hmm. a couple of articles that I wrote at Elie Wiesel Kahn's World.
Yeah.
I had the same idea that some of this information will break the spell. It can break the spell.
Yes.
Everything you've got in your book is so excellently put together that my feeling when I'm reading it is that if anybody who reads this will be convinced, will not be able to hold on to any ideas that they had before, because it's doing such a great job of breaking through those untruths and so on. But and I've been thinking about this before we got together here, Nick.
Right.
Why they don't, and I say it's because they won't read it. They don't even want to read it. I mean, people won't look at this information because they don't want to change their mind. They're happy with where they are. Well, the fact that your academic community, they know that their jobs depend on it, and so they don't want to have their mind changed. And I think most of the people won't even read it and won't even look at it, because if they did, they would have to. It would break through to them. Something would break through.
But do you think they automatically would lose their jobs? I mean, is there some slight thing they could do, or doubt or question, or do you think any doubt they just lose their job? Is this just something where you're totally not allowed to talk about?
Well, that's my impression. Yeah, they're just more comfortable not having any doubt come in by reading or looking at it, looking into this information.
Yeah.
You know, if they...
Well, it is like an enchantment. Let me ask you, if I may, about your campaign, wonderful campaign with Eli Wiesel, pointing out that he hasn't got any tattoo on his arm. I mean, let me suggest this is what we mean by enchantment, okay? Mm-hmm. You've got the Messiah of the Holocaust... who goes around talking to the president and charging $20,000 per lecture and whatever, and he hasn't even got the tattoo on his arm. I mean, how is that possible, Colonel? I just don't get it.
Well, there you go. See, when I started that, I thought, oh, well, we'll play up this tattoo issue and he won't be able to show it, and this will really make an impression. And I really kept going with that, working so hard at it, because I had this idea that, boy, if it could just... bring down Elie Wiesel, that would be such a big blow to the whole Holocaust story. It would be so great. Well, I haven't even made a dent in that, even though I have the followers and those who already know like it. But those who don't know, no, they're not listening. And so it's the same thing, that you think you can reach people, but they're not reachable. They don't want to be reached. So...
But how about that guy who was writing a book showing the identity theft, that there really was someone else with that number which he claimed to have, who really was at Auschwitz, and you talked about how he was publishing a book.
Nicholas Gruner.
Right, that's right, yes. Yeah, didn't that have some effect?
I have his book, you know, and I read it all and used it, and I've talked to him personally on the phone once, but the problem is that when he sees that I'm not a Holocaust believer, then he says he doesn't trust me and he's not going to talk anymore.
Really?
Well, wow. He talked for a while, but, you know, he's a funny character because he sees right through Elie Wiesel, but he doesn't question the Holocaust itself at all, and he tells stories about his own experience there, which can't be true.
Right, yeah.
So he's kind of a mixed up guy, but I do believe that he was sincere about what he knew about Wiesel, and I do believe he did go and get all these documents.
Yeah, I'd have thought with that book Night being studied in so many American colleges and 12 million sold, that the American public would want to hear about what you discovered about his tattoo. You know, I just can't see how they don't want to hear about it.
I know. Well, that same thing. When I read your book, I think it's so excellent. And I think, boy, anybody reading this could not stand up against his argument.
Well, I'll tell you something.
Those arguments. It's all about, you come to it from a scientific standpoint. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Continue.
Yeah, no, that's fine, yeah.
So we can go into this a little bit more later, but let's tell the listeners, if there are any that don't already know, how you've approached this as a scientist.
Well, I first got in with comparing the two main chemical analyses. People had bravely gone and chipped away at the walls of Birkenau and Auschwitz, German Rudolph and Fred Leuchter, and they'd used the same scientific method and procedure, and therefore their two different data sets could be directly compared, and putting them together told a very simple story and totally unequivocal. And any weaknesses each survey may have was counterbalanced by the strength of the other survey, you know, that they totally reinforce each other, which is what science is supposed to be about. And that gives you a memory of what happens, your best memory of how the zyklon cyanide was used 70 years ago. Okay, it's a chemical memory, the best memory we've got. And it clearly shows that all the gas was used in the little delousing chambers out at Birkenau, which are written out in history books where the walls are bright blue, and it wasn't used in any alleged human gas chamber. And so it shows a terribly simple conclusion that the gas killed bugs, not Jews. This what caused all the furore. But what was so interesting for me was that people couldn't bear to talk about it. Nobody asked me about what I'd actually published. I just got this terrific incantation of abuse, you know, oh God, we found a Nazi, how awful. So I began to wonder what was going on in my bewilderment, and I started therefore reading, getting more correspondence with the CODOR people on the CODOR side, stood up for me, and they seemed to think it was finally I'd done, and so that sort of kept me going a bit. And then a British revisionist group slowly started up, and we got to start at a British website, and we discovered the staggering fact that there's a whole lot of data out in West London, Public Record Office, of decrypts that the British intelligence had made for a whole year during the war of all the German labour camps. And there's this chap, Nick Terry, you know, the historian at Exeter, who talked about them and tried to pretend they showed some sort of meaning, or he was arguing that it shows a failure of British intelligence not realising the Holocaust is going on. But I mean, basically they do not show any sign of any Holocaust at all, and that's why all the hundreds of books published on the Holocaust, they don't mention these vital decrypts, you know. And we've just had a British Jewish historian apologising for how, they came out in the 1990s. And a British historian apologised for the failure of British intelligence not to realise that the Holocaust was going on. And I could mention, Caroline, that it's just around the same time as the Catholic Church grovelled with apology because its Pope failed to realise that the Holocaust was going on. And it's just about the same time the International Red Cross also apologised because its report, very detailed, bonky report in the German labour camps, failed to realise that the Holocaust was going on. So we just took these decrypts at face value. They show what was actually happening in the camps. And that is why I could publish a book on the subject. Those decrypts not only described day to day over 12 months what was going on in the camps, but they also had this terrific data set of every day, number of people coming and going from the camps, and the total number of people living in the camps. And they broke that total number down into the four groups, Poles, Russians, Jews and German political prisoners. So that database is then very compatible with various other databases that I'm sure you're familiar with, Caroline, like the Allison Archive, you know, and the, for example, the death books of Auschwitz. That gives you the number of people who die at Auschwitz, which is very, so important and valuable to compare that with the number of people living at Auschwitz, which the decrypts give you, okay?
Right.
I've been a school maths teacher, and that having those numbers was just lovely. I mean, it's real figures at last. The number of people actually living and dying in the camps. That clears away the hocus pocus of what politicians have said, because it is absolutely immediate raw data. And as a science historian, I'm trained to go for the primary source data, to look out for it and base judgments on what you call original data. And so that's why I'm happy about the book, because it is based on this primary source data.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, that the thing that you have that's new. Well, what I really like about your book, after the title, is also that you've got this new thing in it about the decrypts that the British managed to get. And in the end, you know, they speak well for the Germans. That's
That they
did break that code and they did learn all that, because if we could get people to listen to what they show, they back up the idea that that there was no Holocaust and that there was a labor camps. And what was actually going on. And then, as you say, the actual death counts, which correspond with these various sources that we should normally think of as authoritative, the Red Cross, the Auschwitz death books that were discovered there, you know, where they kept the records of all of that, and other sources, and now these decrypts. They all agree. And yet, once again, we're under this spell that there's a 6 million, and you can't question that, and that's the actual fact. Well, when every newspaper in the world has been telling its readers that since 1945 or 6, it's easy to understand why people have that stuck in their minds.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, well, the Spellbreaker's Manual that I've published, right? How to Break the Spell, How to Be a Spellbreaker. Mm-hmm. So it's a self-empowering book, How to Be a Spellbreaker. That 6 million is a terribly important number to use. Firstly, it echoes right through the 20th century. It's endless newspaper headlines, nearly 200 some people have found, from the end of the 19th century right up to 1945, when 6 million Jews at Nuremberg suddenly have been killed, okay?
Yes.
And then the other way in which 6 million appears is the total, this is a quite amazing figure, is the total number of people, nearly all Jews, who have held out their hand for reparations on the grounds that they are Holocaust survivors to Germany. So Germany has been unwittingly creating all these endless Holocaust stories by offering money, well over 100 billion Deutschmarks is paid out, to anyone who can give a story of being a Holocaust survivor. Now, they may have paid out only about 4 million people, but the total number of people who have applied is, I think, 6 million, the nearest million. So that is, and that is obviously far, far more than the number of Jews who ever lived in all the lands ever occupied by National Socialists, right? Mm-hmm. That number is roughly half that. You've got something like 3 or 4 million Jews in all the countries ever occupied by National Socialists, and you've got a much larger number than that have now applied for the cash. So as Robert Forreston so rightly points out, all these Holocaust survivors are not living testimonies to the Holocaust. They are living refutations of the Holocaust, because there are so many of them. Mm-hmm. Just by their numbers, they refute the basic story that they are claiming to tell. I think that's a terribly important irony that's come in now, which Germany is unwittingly generated by this dreadful amount of cash it's paid out.
We know that Germany was forced to accept all this guilt and accept the findings of the Nuremberg Tribunal. And then they were forced to agree to these reparations. They really didn't have any choice, because Germany has been there's never been a peace treaty. So
no.
They're still the masters of Germany, so to speak. Germany has to go along with what's done. So this is another part that has to be, I think, cleared up before people can really understand why the Holocaust is not what it's been made out to be. Germany keeps saying, oh, yes, it was. Oh, yes, we're guilty of all this. Most people are not going to challenge it.
No. Are there many people in Germany now in jail for thought crime, for doubting the Holocaust? Is that happening quite a lot now?
Well, I hear numbers that shock me. They're not all in jail, but people have been found guilty of whatever in the past year or so. And how many are in jail? Well, I don't keep up with that as well as I should either.
But books are still being burnt and banned in Germany, aren't they?
Yes.
That's quite a lot.
And you can't say a word, you know. You can't speak up about anything. And what we have to recognize, too, which is another difficult and sensitive area, is that this is all Jew-imposed. It's all Jewish-imposed laws and rules, really. The governments of the Allies nations benefit to some extent, and they benefit from the war narrative going this way, but not to the extent that, as you pointed out, with the those who are the survivors, in quotes, who are getting compensation and the money that's gone to Israel and all the aid for Israel from Germany, that Germany still has to get.
And nuclear submarines. They've just given their fifth nuclear submarine to Israel. I mean, can you believe it?
Yeah, I can. It makes me pretty sick. But
sure does.
You have to take this into consideration
to
understand why this is still going on and why there's no let up and why it is basically Jewish imposed. And I agree with the fact that many, many Jews are just as much victims of the propaganda as the whites are and everybody else is. But still, it is an international Jewish conspiracy, so to speak. I would call it a conspiracy. How about you?
Well, it's terribly difficult to assess that side of things. I mean, throughout Europe now, there's a whole of Central Europe where it's a crime to doubt the Holocaust, or a crime. People are put in jail. They've got Holocaust type laws. They can't as such say the Holocaust, but it implies that they'll put you in jail if you're found denying the Holocaust. I wouldn't as such say it was a Jewish plot. I mean, manifestly, the story was brewed up by British and American military intelligence at Nuremberg. That's what I would say. I mean, obviously there are Jewish influences and people at work, but...
They put mostly Jews in charge of all of that, except for the most, you know, the highest levels, they didn't, but they had all Jews in the background, and so they had that agenda.
Mm. Well, the way I'd describe, recommend people discussing the matter, mm-hmm. when people start talking about the Holocaust, just point out that in the labour camps, Jews are a minority. And Auschwitz, they're only about 40% Jews. And I think for most of the labour camps, you know, it's fluctuating around that sort of level. There are generally more Poles than Jews. And in death books of Auschwitz, you get more Catholics than Jews dying. They don't have a special privileged position. They have the special position of being chucked out of Germany. Germany wanted to get rid of most of its Jews and flush them out eastwards. But in the German labour camps, their position is not at all unique. I mean, and certainly they're not vilified or damned in the camps. They were decrypt, show them being referred to perfectly respectfully for the different skills they've got. And for example, the orchestra at Auschwitz had mainly or a lot of Jews in it, one, two of the orchestras. Their claim that they've got some special victim status is not warranted by what happened in the German labour camps. I think we need an ability to do history describing the German labour camps and whatever purpose of them might have been without this single focus on Jews this and Jews that. I mean, they are a part of the story.
Well, I would go along with that altogether. I'm just saying that since then, I think they're the by far the largest part that's keeping it in place and not allowing the questioning and the what should naturally be going on, where you know, with the wartime propaganda and atrocity propaganda, it should naturally, you know, insight and discussion. There should be discussion about it and revision. Should be taking place, but they're the main ones who are putting their foot on that and stopping that, and they seem to have the power to do so.
So is it part of their self-identity that they need to believe in this? Wouldn't they be much happier if they could give up the belief in it and realize?
A lot of Jews would, but see that would allow Jews to do more what's called. Integrating into the Gentile world, and they don't want that. So those who are leading this, God only knows really what's behind all this. It's sometimes I think I probably don't even know the well-known names that we talk about, but who really knows what's behind it all? But it's
the purpose of my book is, in a sense, I don't answer these ultimate questions, but the purpose is to enable people to have interesting discussions of the matter. As it were, without losing your friends, you know, how to be able to allude to factual issues if you can stay with definite factual issues, people can remain calm. It's so easy get into a situation where people just boil over the top and they storm out and you've lost your friends, you know.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, Nick, and I've always said, you know, I'm happy to stick with the facts, and if we just stick with the facts, we'll get somewhere, but it's the facts that we're not allowed to stick with.
Yeah, I was saying in British schools today, you get massive indoctrination. It's the most heavily taught in British schools, and the technique is totally medieval. In medieval times, the priest could decree what you had to believe, and then damn you if you didn't accept his belief. Oh, you're the spawn of Satan. Now we're emulating you. And that's exactly what's happening in modern education in this country, that a single Holocaust narrative is given. And anyone who doesn't believe is, Nazi. Mm-hmm. And that is it's an incantation, Caroline. I find that the most extraordinary thing. When people are saying this to me, nobody would ever tell me what a Nazi was, okay? I thought Nazis hadn't existed for 50 years. But
You thought what for 50 years?
I thought Nazis hadn't existed for 50 years, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just something in the past. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, oh, Nazi, is he a Nazi? And it's an incantation that does not have a defined meaning. It's the ultimate kind of evil thing. It's the worst thing anyone can call you, apparently. And it's almost the same word as Zion, isn't it? It's almost the same letters. And it's obviously a very, very similar ideology to Zionism. It's a hate incantation. It's a question of what to do when that happens.
Nazi is an invented word. I myself have spoken up for where it has a certain origin among the National Socialists, and
as a
short, you know, a short nickname. Germany, but it wasn't ever used officially, and it wasn't used that much. But it's been used consistently and solely by the opposing forces ever since even the 1930s or so, I guess. And always, and I noticed you use the word Nazi. I can understand that it's...
Yeah, I probably shouldn't.
It fits what people are talking about. Nobody's talking about National Socialism. When the Holocausters speak about this particular party that was in power, they never call them National Socialists or the NSDAP or anything. They call them Nazis, as though everybody that was associated there was some kind of whatever a Nazi's supposed to be. I think if we don't correct some of these things, that's partly why they can keep up this spell, because they've got these words and they've got these ideas of Nazi evil that people want to cling to, even if you give them a lot of facts, as you do and others have done, why this is not true and that's not true and so many...
Yeah, I think casting a spell is very much to do with having certain key words, isn't it? It's very extraordinary. That's what a magician would have said in olden times, you know, the words for making a spell. And as you say, Nazi, and misusing the word Semitic, for example. Obviously, that refers to the Arab-Palestinian people and not to the white Ashkenazi Khazars who have come to Israel, you know. That word has to be misused and is always misused in our culture. And the word Holocaust has to be misused. That means a fiery sacrifice. Mm-hmm. As in, if you remember long ago, there was the nuclear holocaust. But that's the correct use of the word. And these key terms get misused in the enchantment process that people are given. I was just saying that in schools today, they get taught it in about four different classes, you know. Holocaust this, the holocaust that. In a way that it's the only thing in the school curriculum in which no kind of doubt is permitted. You know, no kind of discussion is allowed, no kind of developing alternate views. Pupils are not invited to make up their own mind, you know, they're allowed to read different stories and make up their own mind. I wonder if you've come across this at all, Caroline,
I was just going to say, because I did a study even in my own town where I live, back a few years ago, and I went to the schools and asked them about their... Of course, I already knew what the school programs were in general, and asked them about their Holocaust teaching programs, and they didn't know. They thought I was just interested from, you know, of a believer's point of view, and so they were telling me all about it, and I was meeting with teachers, and, you know, they started in the first grade, and there were these kids in very young grades, they're talking about it, and then they had a big program in the fourth grade, and a big program in the eighth grade. That's where they really do it. In the high school, they have some of it, but it's kind of connected with history, World War II history, then they'll have their Holocaust. They'll give 4 to 6 weeks for it, too, which is
incredible. Bloody hell.
Take that much time out of it. This is not a big Jewish area where I live, but... They've got it. They do it. They get it in everywhere. I mean, the Texas school system has just accepted it. And once they accept it, they are given this program to do, and everybody does it. What you said is that they bring it forth with such a manner, just like when you see these politicians attending these memorial anniversaries and so on, they all get that look on their face, and there's all this solemnity and so on. And so you're encouraged right there that this is something that you don't make light of at all, and in the schools they're encouraged right off the bat without even having to be told. Well, you can't. They don't say you can't question this, but these kids are scared to death if they should. I suppose he would get quite the lecture. All the other students would look down on him or her. And
obviously needed a very powerful spell weaver to get a spell as powerful as that.
Right, right. So I think there's a lot to talk about in your book, and you've got it divided up into the history that never happened, and then part two, science or religion, and part three, opening the gates of memory. And I think a lot of your best scientific commentary is in part one, where you really, really go into it and make it clear that that this is all, as you're just saying, like a spell that's been woven over everything.
Yeah.
But the idea of what can be done about it is also important. Which I think is good if we touch on, of why you can't change people's minds. And my first suggestion is that people are discouraged from ever looking at it and they're ever reading any of this material. That's why they describe it the way they do. That's why they call you a Nazi. Is why would somebody want to read what you said? Because you're obviously not honest.
Yeah. Well, I would favor in America, Caroline, the Native Americans being assertive, and demanding that Holocaust studies classes and Holocaust study memorials refer to what has happened to them and not anybody else. I mean, that is the real Holocaust in America, is it not? So tell me, Caroline, supposing a Native American teacher at a school wants to include in Holocaust studies what has happened to the Native Americans, do they get dismissed or do they get told off, or do they lose their job, or can they teach?
Oh, no. In fact, as a matter of fact, that's another one of the major special themes and teachings that go on in the grade schools and in high school, too. But they start out early there, too, and they tell about how terrible it was what happened to the Native Americans. And
is that a Holocaust? Is that
fault?
Is that a Holocaust? Is that taught as a Holocaust?
Well, no, naturally they wouldn't call it a Holocaust, but I think they call it a genocide. I'm sure they do. I was substitute teaching for a while, and I did go to some grade schools, and they've got these films that they show. The teachers only have to have this little lesson plan that they're given, and they just follow it, and it's all done, and the kids get very angry at their own at the Americans, the white Americans, and what they did to the Indians, and they go on and on about it. So that's another issue
I would suggest that is the only Holocaust that Americans should focus on, and they should use the word Holocaust for that if they're going to use it at all. I mean, in neither case is it correct, okay? Because Holocaust means a burning fiery sacrifice. But if you want to use the word, people do want to use the word, I think in America it should only be applied to Native Americans, and Holocaust museums should be only about that and not about a alleged genocide in Europe, which didn't in fact happen.
Yeah, many people have made that argument.
It doesn't get anywhere
because people want to talk about the Holocaust of the Jews. That's the only one they really care about.
Is this a religious thing about God's chosen people? Is this from reading the Bible? I feel Jews are God's chosen people, and therefore what happened to them in World War II is infinitely more important than what happened to anybody else. Is it something like that, Caroline?
Well, I don't think it's mostly religious, although it exists there. It certainly is in this, Christian Zionist churches, which is very, very big in the United States. That's a big part of Christianity here. But I think it's some kind of, we can't explain the power that the Jews seem to exert to make themselves so important. And actually, they've been doing it all through history, because even in, if you go to the biblical days.
Well, you've got to remember, Caroline, you have got at least 2% of Jews in America, and that is a lot, right? That is a hell of a lot. And we have got about half of 1% of Jews in this country, and they have a pretty damn strong influence here.
Oh, very.
So I mean, that is the first point to make. You've got a lot of
Right. I mean, they all came rushing here in around 1900, you know, earlier and later, but around that.
I think the Great Diaspora surely began around 1938. You see, the main centre of world Jewry was East Europe, Poland, Hungary, Romania, up until just before the beginning of the Second World War. And the Great Diaspora then began, and Germans chucking out the Jews was just part of that. And they spread out, and after the war, they regathered in two places, Israel and America. Mm-hmm. And that's why you've got like 10% of Jews around New York and so on. That is the Great Diaspora, the tremendous movement that happened. And maybe if people could look at this a bit more, it would get over the idea of some sort of extermination in Europe, which didn't happen. I mean, it was basically a movement out from East Europe, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you're right about that. But the Jews got control in the United States in the great numbers that they came around 1900. I mean, it wasn't, you know, before and after,
right,
and so on.
Right.
Around that period of time. And they filled up New York. They got control of New York politically. And then, you know, they got more and more in control of major industries, newspapers, which was all that there was at that time, and Hollywood. And and then they got into the universities, too. And that was what allowed all this power that they had in the 30s to influence. And you did a great job of describing what the Jewish, I know you don't want to get hung up on Jews, but what the Jews were saying, international Jewry was saying about going to war with Germany and defeating
Germany, yeah,
and so on. You had these various sources. I quoted them.
Yeah, Well, I wanted to make out why Germany should not feel so guilty about Jews being put into separate camps in the end of the 30s. All through the 30s, Jews have been declaring war on Germany. Then they said they were going to start a war against Germany. Then, when it finally began, they claimed credit for having started and said it was their war. And given that all this is happening, I can't see that Germany has anything to feel desperately ashamed about just because they did something which every other country in Europe has found necessary to do at one point or another, namely chuck them out. I mean, so many countries sort of want to be nice to Jews and have been nice to Jews, and then they experience that sting, whatever it is, which we're not allowed to talk about, and there is expulsion in follows. And British Edict of Expulsion was in 1293, out of England for 300 years. I don't think Germans should feel ashamed of that. It's a historical process, and it's been misrepresented. I think it's our business. We're kind of friends of Germany to tell Germany what they did. They're not allowed to write their own history. Germans are not allowed to tell their own history. And it's our business to describe what they did and why, why that's not something they should feel endlessly ashamed about.
Well, I thought that was a great, great part that you wrote there, and I really appreciated it. And I thought, well, that, you know, he's done a great job there of bringing up some sources that I didn't know about. And it was just a general overall direction coming from some, what you can call the International Jewish Center, you know, well-known rabbis and both mm-hmm. Zionist leaders, some mm-hmm. U.S. Rabbis and leaders and so mm-hmm. on. And they coordinated this idea that Germany was trying to wipe out the Jews. They started that early on.
Well, that's one terrific thing I think has happened now, that the Goebbels diaries have now been thoroughly published, all in German, quite a bit published in England, and people who have read right through them are totally clear that the Endlösung der Judenfrag is always a territorial thing. It means moving the Jews out eastwards. Mm-hmm. It means flushing them out, and it's the goal or end solution. It does not mean extermination. There are some phrases where people are angry with the Jews, but it is not correct to describe that as extermination. And that's just only happened recently, Carol. I think there's so much that's happened recently. People need to understand that the great triumphs and achievements of revisionism, a lot of this is recent. For example, the Goebbels diaries. And I could mention the other thing which we'd feel proud of, the tremendous sequence of books by Carlo Mattogno. Okay? These may not be a gripping read, because they're quite technical. But Carlo Martogno reads Polish, German, and Italian, and so he can access all these Middle European sources. And I think his books translated to English is an absolutely vital source for revisionist truth. And I think we're now in this period now. The revisionists have totally won the arguments, in essence. Any debate in public, revisionists are going to be seen to win. And I think that's a terrific change we're going through now. I mean, I could write my book because of these wonderful researches that's been done quietly and in the backgrounds by revisionists. As you say, I think this makes clear, really, the first time, what happened.
Well, right, so some of this is, but people were saying it, but nobody was, they just dismissed them as being biased or something.
Yeah. Tell me, Caroline, do you feel that we're at a turning of the tide now? Because I look at web comments, whenever something's published on the Holocaust, I go straight to the comments, and I notice most of them are sceptical in England, whereas I notice in America there's more of a tendency to believe the official story. But otherwise, lots of international articles, the comments are mainly angry and sceptical these days, whereas 5 or 10 years ago, it was different. Do you have an impression of some great change, possibly because people are fed up with what Israel's been doing in Gaza and so forth, that people have just had enough of this story?
Well, sure. I think that's slowly happening. But they're working very hard. It's just a question of you have to understand what they're doing. But it may be all backfiring that they have to work so hard to bring up this evil now. It's evil to be anti-Semitic. I think this is a losing argument because people are not going to go. You can't have all this free democracy that you're promoting and equality for everyone and so on. And it's at the same time say that that people cannot speak about a certain group in a negative way because of whatever, there's no reason. They don't have any reason for it, really, but they just want to impose these laws. And they have,
their
agents there in the European Union and the European Parliament there that they've created. They're willing to go along with all of that and pass these laws, but there's not enough of them. I hope people will hold out on that because it's, to make a Europe-wide law against anti-Semitism, and then they describe in as general terms what anti-Semitism is, and that you can't be that is the height of lunacy. Because if somebody doesn't want to like somebody, they don't have to like them.
No, right. And it doesn't apply to anyone else. It doesn't apply to Muslims or Arabs.
No.
It doesn't apply to English people. You can be as rude as you want to an English person, and they just want some special. Always want some special protection in law, as if they might be offended.
Well, that's kind of the history of the Jewish movement, increase of Jews in Europe and so on and around the world. Is that when they go into new areas, they have to be getting special protections along with it, and they try to get special protections everywhere. And that's their history in the United States. If you read what, like, even just Henry Ford's The International Jew, talks a lot, or his writers talk a lot about how the Jews came into the United States. And away, they were organizing to make sure that they had laws protecting them. And they we have all these groups coming into the United States, and all these immigrant groups. Nobody else acted like that, did that, but the Jews do it, and they're very good at it, and they get.
Yeah, that happened 1,000 years ago when William the Conqueror came into England, and he brought Jews with him because they had a knack of squeezing money out of the population, and he could then get taxes off them, and there were special laws protecting the Jews, and the word one Jew is worth 10 Christians or something in court, and so they were brought into this country with special laws protecting them.
So they're just following that in a, just using reason. I mean, if the Jews have always needed to have special laws protecting them because people didn't like them or would somehow harm them or try to kick them out or whatever, usually ended up that way. Then, but other people don't have these and don't ask for them, and Then there's got to be something about the Jews. It's not about people. They want to make out. And this is so obvious to anybody, unless you're just totally under this spell, that the problem is with the Jews. The problem is not with the other groups who are supposedly anti-Semitic or find fault with them or don't in their countries or in their neighborhoods.
I've always appreciated having Jewish friends, but I'm a bit sort of nervous when that subject comes up. I wish I could raise this subject with them, but I never quite managed to, you know.
You're like me with the Christians. I don't want to offend Christians, but and Christian friends. But at the same time, I would say things that I could say things, but I don't want to say them to them. So I guess that's maybe one of the areas where we're not able to be as open and honest as we think. And like, and it's in the area of religion, isn't it? Because you're saying that Holocaust is religion, and you talk about that.
It has turned into the great modern religion, right. And it accesses far deeper emotions than, at least in my experience, far deeper emotions than any other religious studies.
And when it's religion, then we're hesitant to talk to a person who's believing in that religion. We're hesitant to question their religion. Now with the Holocaust, it goes further to where you will be legally responsible for being a criminal.
This is a strange business, isn't it? I mean, the whole of Russia recently just passed a law, Putin did, or at least the Russian parliament, banning denouncing the Holocaust. And I find it very amazing that this is progressing in Europe. I mean, Spain undid their law. That's the one bright spark of hope. Spain repealed its law of denying the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. But most other countries seem to...
We know it does have largely to do, I think, Nick, with they want to protect their World War II narrative.
Yeah.
That's what's going on with Putin in Russia, and that's what's going on with the British, I think, basically. And the United States, they want to protect that World War II narrative. But that World War II narrative goes further than just showing them as being the victors and the good guys. It goes deeper than that. It goes into the kind of world order they are agreeing to set up.
Yeah. For me, what people call Holocaust denial is like switching on the light. And once you switch on the light, you can see what's what. Mm-hmm. Europe desperately needs to have a real discussion of World War II and what the hell was it about, you know? Why did 60 million people die? Why has Britain twice declared war on Germany in the 20th century? And we can't have that discussion. At the moment, you just use about two words is all you need, Hitler and Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And that terminates discussion, you know? That's it. End of discussion. And you all know who to hate, don't you? And so it's a vehicle or a means of political control, as if we need to be controlled, and that is, yeah. I find the reason I like the company of revisionists. I actually like hearing talk about World War II. I don't know a lot about it, but I really appreciate hearing real discussion of World War II and who did what, and I don't feel that Germany wanted a war in either case, and I think we could struggle to get to the truth in that matter, but we can only do that once you're away from this Holocaust narrative, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that is the first step for human enlightenment.
I'm in total agreement with you, and I have no fear of talking factually and investigating and research and so on into all of the causes and realities of World War II, and that it's going to somehow knock down something that I hold dear that I don't want to let go of or whatever. I just want everything to come out, and I know that Germany will be in a lot better shape when that...
Sorry, well, yeah.
Sure. And so...
Do you feel the first step is for Germany to declare peace and formally end the World War? Would that be a step of sovereignty? If it declared peace, it could ask the occupying nations to leave Germany, Would that? It needs to gain sovereignty, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not formally sovereign, is it?
Yes, I agree with that. Yes, I know that they are legally supposed. From what I understand, they're legally not able to do that. But they don't. Who has to pay attention to that kind of law? Well, you think the United States is going to attack Germany today because they're you know insisting on removing their troops there, and they're insisting on becoming a fully sovereign nation and having a full peace treaty? They say that this peace treaty, that this reunification treaty, which determined the forever and forever borders of Germany that could never be changed, the present borders were permanent.
Yeah.
Now that's supposedly their peace treaty, but it wasn't, and legally,
no, it wasn't.
So this is all a game that they're playing in Germany. They've got everybody there now in control who goes along with it. So Germany goes along with it because the people who would oppose it are in such a minority, and they're afraid to speak up also because of the very things that have happened to you and that you've been discussing.
Mm. Well, let's hope Germany can let its historians out of jail and allow its historians to tell the history of their own nation.
I don't see why we couldn't have a big movement. I think a lot of people would join that movement that would be just based on that. Free Germany, let the people...
Historians out of jail.
That are based on these laws that they passed. Germany needs a constitution ratified by the people without the top-down insistence that it be this or that. Germany needs to let up on its security services, which are all aimed toward what's supposed right-wing people in Germany. You can't have a right-wing in Germany, but you can have a left-wing and a communist wing. You have communist parties and so on. They need to, they need to let go of that. They need to fashion themselves after the United States. Well, look at all the freedom we still have here in the United States.
Yeah, you've got a very, very right-wing. We say your party is a very right-wing.
What? Which party?
Well, we say politics in America is very right-wing, but you don't have a left-wing in America.
No, not
that's the way. Yeah. But, you know, in Europe, all the countries in Europe, you're getting new right-type movements burgeoning, and these are concerned with trying to maintain or affirm traditional culture and traditional values as it's being quickly swept away by so-called multiculturalism, you know. And so I think the new right is a force. It's still very ethically damned. I mean, in Britain, the new right can't meet publicly without being vilified and, you know, you get called a Nazi, obviously. But these are people who want to maintain traditional culture and civilization, traditional values and civilization, and they're called the new right. So perhaps that is a force that may not be stoppable, you know.
Well, it could be. It could be that's what, you know, at least it's happening, and it could be the sign of what's going to come in the future. It could also be abrogated or just stopped in its tracks, you know, could be really going nowhere. And it could also be infiltrated, which has happened again and again, that whenever there are these movements to go against the powers that be, then they are infiltrated with people who become incompetent and cause problems, and next thing you know, the people are dropping out and the whole thing is failing. So when you see failure in this, I think there's something behind it. And we have to realize how big the powers that be are and how, therefore, how big of a resistance they would have going on or this kind of program to stop anything growing up against them. It's pretty hard. I just, you know, I go back to why I like your book so much, and you, is because you're a scientist and you come at it, the whole, just going back to the Holocaust, which is a kind of cornerstone of all the, what holds this all together. Come at it from this very clear, easy to follow scientific perspective, and can really against it, so they don't. They just say, they just call you, as you say, call you names and try to keep reading it.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny the way I did it, because it was something I was interested in. And after I was thrown out of my college, I was told that it was the only thing that important in my life, you know, is that the thing I'd done, and nobody seemed interested in anything else I'd done in all my life, which was very bewildering. And, oh, God, I was the Holocaust denier of Britain. And and I couldn't get any jobs or anything else. So in a sense, I had to write the book, you know. People were defining me as this was the subject, and yet there was this terrific silence all around, you know. People didn't want to talk about it. And if I just found a few ethically damned right-wing people, new right, that they would talk about it. And this was so strange for me that I kind of had to write the book, see what I mean? I'm very glad if it does make sense. Yeah.
I just think it's just perfect for today, for now. Mm-hmm. The thing is how to get it into the hands of more people. And I suppose some of the things that I tend to say is not the way to get it into the hands of more people, because you don't want to make people afraid of your subject matter by saying, "Well, I don't want to get involved with those right wing nutcases or whatever."
maybe the thing we've been talking about, Caroline, about education, how teachers should tackle this subject, given that they do have to tackle a subject, we should argue that they need a diverse approach, which different narratives are permitted, and pupils are allowed to make up their own mind. Maybe we should request this in modern educational curriculum. That's one thing I think might be worth trying.
Well, I think that would certainly make those who don't want that look bad, you know, and certainly point out that this is not allowed, and why is this not allowed? So I think that's a good idea. How do you, you know, getting a kind of an organized thing going, but it just takes somebody who wants to name something and say, well, this, we got this group here called this, and we want to do this, and then people will gather around it and support it.
Right.
So that would be one thing that you could follow up, you and your friends could follow up with from this book. You know, I noticed that a lot of your friends and associates are people who have been, I don't know if you call them on the left. I guess the left would not call them on the left, but I would call them more on the left, like Spencer and Kevin Barrett and some of those others who have really changed quite a bit. I know Kevin Barrett has changed quite a bit in being open to... And so people like that, it would be really helpful, I'm sure, to get them to be more active in the cause of truth about it, as you just the way you put it. That would be a good idea. You do talk about this thing, a just law, in your appendixes. I thought some of your appendixes were very good. I like the one of your rights, and you go through a whole lot of the organizations that have been created which keep the Holocaust in place, and you talk about them, and I think that's so. You want to comment on that any?
Well, basically, what I try to say in those appendices is that when somebody is summoned to a trial for allegedly denying the Holocaust, the laws, they may wish they could say, oh, we ban denying the Holocaust, but they can't. They have to say, oh, we want to ban any discourse that might disturb the public peace. And then they try to imply that you're a Nazi and therefore you're liable to disturb the public peace. And that is a quite... defensible. You can defend yourself, and indeed, in a sense, it's fairly absurd. For example, you can point out that books do not disturb the public peace. No book published ever disturbs the public peace. It just doesn't happen. And also discourse of revisionists. If they've talked to each other, there's absolutely no way that could disturb the public peace. So the nature in which the laws are formulated, It's presupposed that the revisionist goes to jail, but it should not in fact be so. The revisionists can clearly explain and defend in a court that there's no way his belief disturbs the public peace. Indeed, it's far more the Holocaust fanatics who disturb the public peace. They go through, invade you to check out your library or whatever. That is far more disturbing the public peace than a few revisionists talking to each other. So my arguments, I look at British, French and German law basically, is that someone should be able to defend themselves against this extremely vague notion of liable to disturb the public peace. That's what the way in which most of these laws are formulated. That it's up to the person prosecuting to give evidence if the peace has been violated or is likely to be violated. And it's not up to the person accused to defend themselves, because that's you can't prove a negative statement like saying, I am not disturbing the public peace. The prosecutor should have the onus of showing that whatever is the revisionist has done, like publishing a book, why on earth should that disturb the public peace? Mm. And I think that people should be able to. I mean, there's a few exceptions, like Fred Tobin. I think he does have very controversial language that is liable to disturb the public peace, you know, down under. But even so, he managed to avoid being arrested in England.
What is so wrong with his language? I think he's a very carefully spoken person.
Oh, right. Well, I don't want to go into that too much, but I would say having the national German flag, you know, with the swastika and being seen with it, that kind of thing, in Australia, or that is going a bit far in being provocative. But personally, I passionately believe that we need a revisionist movement that is, in the words of Robert Forreston, a quest for historical exactitude. And it has political implications. We accept there are political implications, but that is not the motive of the people doing the study. That is the all-important thing.
Right.
That your motive...
People do
your
have
motive,
a right to have their political beliefs.
They certainly do, yeah.
Them. I don't know...
They certainly do, yeah, but...
So you think that all revisionists should stay away from any political pronouncements or preferences in order to keep from somehow polluting their message?
Well, not quite, Colin. That's going a bit far. But the legislation throughout Europe is formulated as if there was a danger of the Nazi movement somehow coming back or whatever. And that would be regarded as a cause of breaching the peace, that does actually exist, whether or not we approve of it. Throughout Europe, there is legislation in various ways which acts as if there were some danger of some recrudescence of the German National Socialist movement, which I wouldn't have thought there was personally. But you could be asking for trouble if you're directly concerned about that.
Yeah, I'm looking for this quote from you. I'm sorry. Continue if you were.
Well, I think the important thing is to be seen. Obviously, revisionists are seen generally as quite non-violent and as not producing any sort of public disturbance of the peace. I think it's absolutely clear that is the case. And the people, it's much more people enforcing the Holocaust who, if anything, are seen as disturbing the public peace.
Oh, right. And become violent, too.
Yeah. So you're going to quote something, Caroline.
Yes, I finally found it here. I found this was interesting, and I would like you to say whatever you want to say about this. This is under, in your index about your rights, and this is a 1953 European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights, Article 10. And I think this might be what your comment that you wrote about this,
yeah,
Protection of Human Rights, because you go through a lot of these conventions, uh-huh, and things that have been passed in Europe. And you say, our concern here has been what the Nazis did historically. That is, you know, you're looking simply at the facts about what happened, would not,
yeah,
constitute an endorsement of their actions. Indeed, research into what they did, which is the normal business of a historian, must surely help in enforcing a law prohibiting the promoting of Nazi ideology so that it can be applied more effectively. I found this a little confusing in relation to all the other things you wrote in the book. What are you suggesting there?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're defending yourself in a court of law, that is the kind of theme of this appendix, and people say that, oh, look, you're right about the Nazis, you can just say this is what a historian should be doing, And that doesn't mean that you're trying to promote the ideology of actually, that's what happened, for example, with Irving, David Irving. He's the great historian about World War II, and obviously written some great books on the subject, which I suspect will be remembered when those of his critics have all been deeply forgotten. And he was accused of being pro-Nazi, just because he'd researched the subject in so much depth and gone out and sought out the documents. And he actually wrote about the National Socialist leaders as if they were real human beings, looking at their motives, which I think is fairly unique amongst British writers, you know, or very, very rare. So he found himself prosecuted because of that. And so I'm here trying to say that, that one should be able to defend investigating this subject. Just on those grounds.
Yeah, without it being assumed that you're promoting it, and definitely you don't. I mean, I know I'm. You're clear on that, and that's perfectly fine. And a lot of people don't who are revisionists. So that's what you're saying there. Well, I also heard you on another program that I was listening to parts of it yesterday, and I heard you say, speaking of David Irving, you just kind of made a comment that you thought arrest in Austria and so on had done some damage to him because of the things that, the changes that he made in his outlook on...
Well, I thought that was the great trial with Lipstadt in 2000, that since then it's as if he's changed and become more kind of, not exactly bitter, but we used to think he was a great revisionist, and he was definitely on our side.
Oh, it was that's what you were speaking of, the trial with the...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he was accused of falsifying history, which is outrageous, totally outrageous, being a falsifier of history, and the court had no business whatever to reach such a judgment. Mind you, I'm not clear why Irving took out that libel suit anyway, but he did. After that, for example, he started defending the Hotel Telegram. Mm-hmm. Now, if you like, I could just comment on that.
Yes, please.
Right. The British intelligence decrypts that I referred to earlier were published in the mid-90s, released, and they're now in the Public Record Office, and that's what I published in my book, right? Mm-hmm. Some of it. And all of it, by the way, is on our website, whatreallyhappened.info. Now, the only bit that was of any interest to anyone, around the year 2000, right at the ending of Irving's trial, was this so-called Hotel Telegram, which gives some numbers of people, ostensibly through four different camps, which are part of Operation Reinhardt, that is to say people moving out through those camps, moving eastwards, and they gave some numbers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody published a very, very absurd article in the Genocide Studies Journal claiming that these were mass murders. So the numbers involved, like 800,000 at Treblinka, were people liquidated, okay? And Irving endorsed this view. He totally endorsed it. And he not only endorsed it, but he said, look, you see, please don't call me a Holocaust denier because I am endorsing the Hotel Telegram. And the Hotel Telegram shows that the action was further east than Auschwitz. The real Holocaust was taking place further east, mm-hmm. because, as I'm sure you're aware, these transit camps, like Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, are on the border of what was then Poland and Russia, to do with railway lines going eastwards into Russia, okay? Mm-hmm. So he said, oh, it shows the main Holocaust was happening further east than Auschwitz, and this is the real story. And he seemed to express a degree of certainty about this and said, you know, please don't doubt this, or I might sue you, sort of thing. And revisionists, or, you know, people in CODA are very puzzled by this. What does Irving really believe? Does he think mass gas happened or not? So we're still in this very, I think, very puzzled situation. I mean, the way I would see it, I'm not judging or criticising Irving, okay? There's only so much a man can cope with. And for his livelihood... His livelihood involves going to all these places in Europe where the National Socialists were and looking at archives, okay? Looking at historical documents and interviewing people, talking with people. That's what he's done all his life for his history books, right? And he wants to be able to do that without people saying, oh, God, here comes the Holocaust denier, right?
Yeah.
My feeling is that he's done adopted this rather strange position so that he can get on with kind of the work he's been doing all his life.
His living, too, and also... Yeah. And wouldn't you say that he's concerned about being just his whole reputation being destroyed so that all the work he did, all those books, as you say, such good books, that he wrote would somehow be censored or be not available to people in the future?
Yeah, well, that is the case now. Yeah. That is the case now. He sells his books and he gives talks, which I haven't actually been to, but they obviously have to be in a secret location, you know. But a lot of people want to come and hear him. But I say he's the only British historian that a lot of people want to come and hear. I can't think of any other. Just to go back a bit, in 1992 he published his book on Hitler's war. His publisher Macmillan immediately pulped all his books. That was the end of the rather fine reputation he'd enjoyed, because his book Hitler's War did not indicate Hitler knew anything about a gassing program or an extermination of Jews, mm-hmm. you know. And because of that, his whole reputation was trashed, and suddenly, you know, well, we're familiar with the whole story.
Nick, you see the power that's in this, that a publisher like that will do what you just described. And mm-hmm. presidents and prime ministers, as I was saying the other day on a program on this memorial of the camp openings that they had on Monday that was under the auspices of the World Jewish Congress, France and Germany and Croatia and some others attended. And their camps were open, and all these important people go along with this without the first question. They don't question it whatsoever.
Yeah. Was that, when did you say that was? Last week?
It was Monday.
Monday,
yeah,
all right.
A week ago today.
And where did they go? Where did they go to?
Well, there was three places. They were at Bergen-Belsen. That was the biggest one.
Oh, yeah.
They were at Strutthof Natzweiler in France. That's where President Hollande was. And they were in I can't pronounce it unless I see it in front of me, Genesovic camp in Croatia.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, right. Amazing. And is it the case that Putin didn't go? Putin said he wasn't going. Is that right? Have I got the right?
Oh, no, that didn't have anything to do with Putin. Was just a kind of a small event that I think probably was pushed by, again, I'm sorry, World Jewish Congress, because it was to the anniversary of the opening of the camps. I think it was the anniversary of Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah. You know. If we talk about programming of hypnotizing people, not exactly hypnotizing, but programming, that is when it happens, when they go to an event like that.
When what?
That is when process of programming politicians, of getting them kind of almost hypnotized so they can't doubt it. That is when it happens, when they go to an event like that.
Right, and then when David Irving sees this and sees that Macmillan Publishing will actually pulp his books and so on, and he sees the danger and how big this is, he decides very likely that he's got to kind of make some peace with this and try to make the best out of it, because he can't fight it. You know, it can't be fought. And this is the reality that I look at so often.
Oh, right.
It is so big. But there have to be ways to get at it, to get at people. Get at people to stop being loyal to this and to stop believing in it. And that's what you're talking about.
Break the spell. Break the spell. If I could slightly shift this up, you mentioned Strutthof. That is in France, isn't it? Northern France.
Yeah, well, it's in Alsace-Lorraine.
That's right. Germany. Now that came into the limelight recently because David Cole published his book, mm-hmm. you know, Republican Party Animal. David Cole was outed, right? Mm-hmm. The famous David Cole. He'd been invisible for years. Then he was outed by his ex-girlfriend. And one thing or another, it's all rather dramatic. And his book said, oh, no, I'm not denying the Holocaust. No, I accept that in this camp in Strutthof, or however you pronounce it, that there was gassing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us were rather puzzled by this, so what on earth sort of evidence he thought he had for it. Would you have any comment on that?
Unfortunately, if I don't refresh myself on things, I forget all the details, but I did a whole program about this, and then I think I did two, and I had Guillermo Rudolph, who agreed to come on.
Oh, right.
Programs, and
yeah.
he he doesn't put any stock in David Cole's reasoning there and his evidence and so on. And I'm real happy about that, and he was willing to talk about it. And I've looked into all the everything I could find about it that's, you know, just in English and all the stuff that's written on the various Wikipedia pages about what happened and so on and everything that David Cole said. And it's questionable. There's a lot of versions, and it's nothing definite at all. I think it's just create another one of those creations based on that there is a camp there and there are some prisoners there.
Yeah.
And they get these various camp personnel or people involved to give testimony. But in the end, they had a court case. That was one of the court cases, but they found all those people innocent that they were trying to find guilty of gassing people there at Schutthof Natzweiler.
And was that a French court case, Alsace-Lorraine?
I think it was one of those German... Camp, you know, like the Hamburg trial and this trial and that trial. They had them in there, one of those, maybe with the doctor's trials or something. But it get very complicated with Himmler's program on Anna Nerby, you know, and these people were working in that department, and they were wanted skulls and skeletons of Jews. And so supposedly they got this camp there, Natzweiler, to gas a few Jews and to then clean off the skin, the flesh and so on, and deflesh them. It all gets very gory sounding. But there's no real proof with Treblinka. Yeah. You know, now David Irving is going along with that, but David Cole has added that too, not just Natzweiler, but he's gone along totally with everything David Irving says about Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor.
Oh, no, that's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's very emotional, his book, terrific emotional. I can't really read it. It's terrific passion and emotion all the time. It's as if he just wants to say, oh, God, please don't call me a Holocaust denier. Look, I believe in this and that. Mm-hmm. He then says, oh, there's a paper trail or something. And you look in his appendix, there's no paper trail at all. It's just a shame that that's my impression too, that's what people said on CODOR, that this is just a bit of post-war nasty anti-German propaganda brewed up. And as for Treblinka, I mean, that is, well, we had a big issue, I didn't go over it, but we had a science department from Birmingham University here went out to Treblinka, you know, and it was so farcical what they did. They didn't find any bodies, didn't find any gas chambers, and they just made it up. They just pretended they'd found stuff. It was extraordinary.
Well, right, and here you go. What we have is people are making things up. Little people that, you know, nobody even knows their name, and big people who are famous and so on, all kinds of people, they make things up. And this has to be a human, a human nature problem where other concerns override the concern for truth and the willingness. And maybe there again is that spell thing where people can talk themselves into things.
And perhaps they need the guilt. Perhaps they like the terrific guilt that they feel. Oh, God, you know, what we did to God's chosen people. How awful. So that you will feel guilty forever.
Yeah, you know, speaking of Treblinka, I will bring this up because as I was reading your book, I noticed a typo that Guillermo Arruda has to be a fantastic editor because all those books are so clean and well done. But on page 14,
absolutely. Oh, no.
Reinhard Heydrich's name, his first name is spelled with a T on the end, but he didn't spell it that way. You know, Reinhard, and that what's used for Reinhard camps, which was a person in the National Socialist camp system. Who was in charge of the money and so on, and collecting all the goods from the Jews who were being transported across the border into Russia. That's what those camps were all about, and they call them the Reinhard camps. And then they say it's because of Reinhard Heydrich, because he was in charge of all the death camps and so on. See, and so, but that's an error there. That T shouldn't be there.
No, too. Right.
That's another issue that I don't want to make you go into.
That's quite complicated, isn't it? Of what the Reinhard camps allude to.
But I think that Carlo Mantegna has written about the program for collecting the goods of the Jews who were being finally deported all the way out of the German occupied. But I think at the same time he has accepted that they were named after Heydrich. I disagree with that myself, but I haven't had the time or anything to.
Well, I think it's not entirely clear quite hard to say what the Reinhardt operation was, but let me just say this, that Forreson went to around that Treblinka area, and he talked with a farmer who said he was there during the war, and who gave him some recollections, and one of them was that they used to go up to the door of the camp and exchange food and stuff for things like jewellery and stuff, or you know, bits of bric-a-brac and trinkets that the inmates had, so it doesn't sound as if they got frisked by the Germans to relieve them of all their jewellery. You know, his memory was that they used to trade food and stuff.
Right. I'm familiar with that too, but I wasn't thinking about it along those lines so much. So that's very good, and I agree that probably they didn't take everything from them. They were transporting all kinds of furniture of theirs and so on into these areas where they were going.
Yeah, I mean the amount of staff at Treblinka was so small, the German staff and various other workers. Mm-hmm. I don't really see how they could have done anything against the will of the inmates or anything to annoy the inmates. I would think the staff president
was just... But there was a program, I guess, before they got that far, you know, before they left, they couldn't take everything. So whatever they didn't take, the Germans took hold of. And supposedly, and this man, Reinhardt, was in charge of that program and seeing that it all went to the Reich. It didn't go into anybody's hands. You know, there was no corruption. Nobody was going to be able to steal it or send it to relatives or whatever.
Yeah.
And so
it's
all part of what the Reich needed, and mainly to keep going and to keep fighting the war. So
The Reinhardt operation referred to three camps. All the books are absolutely clear. They referred to these three camps, Treblinka, Sobibor, and Lublin, okay? What got confusing was when the this Hottel telegram, sorry, it's a bit technical, but the Hottel telegram then appeared, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone was talking about it, and that had four camps. It threw in Majdanek as well, which isn't at all on the eastern border of Poland, and that doesn't really make sense. Majdanek wasn't just a transit camp like the others. It was a labour camp. What was it not? And so Hottel's numbers didn't add up at all, because he'd got an extra camp, he'd thrown an extra camp and claimed that was part of this operation. And I think a lot of the confusion came because people accept the whole telling was valid, which I don't think they should. I think it's a rather dodgy item. There's even a possibility.
The Moorhair report come first, and then the Hooflet
program.
Yes.
You're absolutely right, Karen. You're absolutely right. The Moorhair report, I think, is authentic, mm-hmm. and that has a big number of Jews who go eastward, 1.2 million or something, and Hoffman exactly quoted that number at a particular point. I think it was January 43 or something, his total number, the Kohler report. And Hoffman quoted that, but it threw in an extra labour camp, had four instead of three. So I have an appendix when I look at this, and I'm not really happy that telegram made a lot of sense. And it's even possible, some people think, that it was put in to the British decrypts a few years before it was released, possibly by an American intelligence got to look at these decrypts, had them for some years before they were released here in England. So there was even a slight possibility that they may not be authentic at all.
Well, and then when you read I did some work on this too. And when you look at the Kohler report, the full total one in German, and it translated it, you know, and translated into English and so on, it doesn't really say the things that David Cole implies that it says. He interprets it, and then he says that it's absolutely no other way to look at it. It's right there. It's the only way to look at it. Mm. But it's not the only way to look at it. In fact, it's not even the best way to look at it. So these things are cut and dried or slam dunk yet, these two
items. Yeah, I totally agree, yeah. And I wonder if possibly David Cole's a bit kind of alone, that's the impression he gives, in his evaluation of things. I mean, for me, having a group, a British group, that you could consult people and you actually met, that was really vital for my book, being able to do it. But, and then, even when I've done it, having got my Rudolph corrector, it goes through the whole damn thing and corrects stuff. I mean, you need to have something when it's to and fro with a group of you, I think. And I think David Cole might have written it all rather by himself and got muddled up over this. As you said, that Corhair report is a statistical account of people, different people, including Jews, moving eastwards. Mm-hmm. And that is their account at the beginning of 43, as the Reich requested, you know, wanted some. That's what it is. I would have thought that these transit camps are interpreted very straightforwardly in these terms. But you know what, Caroline? Do you think the problem is that what we're saying now is, in a way, relatively uninteresting? It's just statistics of people moving eastwards, okay? And people prefer to have a terrifically exciting drama of big gas chambers and I was the last Jew in Treblinka or something, and the terrific polarity of good and evil. It's so exciting, you know, the wicked Nazis and the good Jews. Do you think people just want that sort of drama?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you there, and that's our problem. As I was kind of referring to earlier, human nature, we've got this problem with human beings not really valuing truth that much as they do what fits somehow into what they think happened, what they've been brought up with, what they're comfortable with, what their biases are, what their political views are, their people they are hang out with, and so on, all that big role. They're not scientific in trying to look at evidence and weigh things back and forth by the factual information.
Well, I'm convinced there's nothing more important than getting proper history intact, and who's in control of the historical narrative, as if that is somehow, there's a terrific struggle to find the real history. And the process of the enslavement of the human race, or however you want to look at it, evolves distorting that past somehow, and protecting our history is I guess that's something revisionists do.
That's right. Revisionists care about the truth of history, and I just find that exceptionally noble and what I agree with. And again, I would like to say too that what would we do without Germar Rudolph? You know, he has been responsible for knowing so much about the facts and where everything is and how things happen that we know. I've gone to him and asked him about things. And I've also asked Carlo Mantonio about things, but I don't have as easy access to Carlo Mantonio. I don't like to bother him. But, you know, it's just that Germar Rudolph, though, has played in the background, sort of, such a huge role in keeping the revisionist movement moving along. He's very committed to it.
Oh, gotcha, that's right. Yeah, it's wonderful having him as a publisher, and it gives me confidence that nearly everything in the book is correct. As you say, I misspelt some.
Well, he didn't pick up that.
Right now.
Or maybe he agrees with that spelling. I don't know. Maybe I can ask him. We could, you know, I'll find out. But
this is one of the more obscure aspects of this labyrinthine subject, whether Reinhardt has got a T on it or not. Yes.
Well, so everything that you cover, everything about Holocaust in the book, and you do it in such an entertaining way. It certainly entertained me in that I found your manner of writing and your tongue-in-cheek type of approach to so many things quite enjoyable. You know, I of course enjoyed it.
Oh, right. I'm surprised. I had another friend who told me my book was amusing. It was making him laugh. I was quite surprised at that, you know.
Oh, yeah, and that lightens things up. Now, some people might pass by them, I don't know. But it doesn't matter because you're not saying anything that's not true. You're just putting it in such a way. So you're a very clever guy, and you have a good sense of humor. You're good-natured, I can tell from that, and anything I've ever heard you speaking is very clear. How fair-minded you are, you don't have any gripes about anybody, you don't have any hates in you about any group, and quite open to everyone, and that's what comes through in this book, and yet all the facts and all the truth point absolutely to that. The Holocaust is, would you call it a hoax?
Well, obviously. Well, I would call it the greatest lie ever told. Okay. I mean, there are three aspects of, as you know, well, three aspects. One is that there was an intention to exterminate a particular ethnic group. Secondly, that they did it by big gas chambers, mainly. And thirdly, that they did in 6 million of them. And there's no truth whatsoever in any of those three propositions. Absolutely no truth. And as such, it is this monumental, awesome, greatest lie ever told. And we have the thrill of living at the time when that is disintegrating, the disintegration of that monster lie. And so that is a very exciting time to be around. And the world will change. The world will change as that disintegrates and as we're free from its baleful influence.
Do you think, it leads us to where we have to ask, don't people have to ask, if they realize even partly what you're saying, why people want to keep this in place? Who's holding this in place and why? What's the purpose of doing so?
Well, that is one of those vast questions. We live in a war-maker civilization, where making war and getting the population to believe in war is the primary requirement. This is the horror of the culture that we live in. It's not a culture that wants or celebrates peace. And the Holocaust, because it was irrational, 6 million Jews were killed for no reason, okay? Mm-hmm. Because it's irrational, it can be invoked any time. Any way you want it. A politician can say, oh, look, if we want to avoid another Holocaust, we'd better do this or we'd better do that. And for goodness sake, we've got to teach everyone about the Holocaust or else such and such might happen. So it's a convenient manipulative tool for politicians who want war because it teaches you who to hate. At a very early age, kids at school are taught to hate Germans, and this is one of the most frightful things it does. What I find mysterious is that in our culture today, the hatred of, Nazi, that is somehow kept alive, even though the war ended, 70 years ago. And the other enemies, like the communists or the Muslims, are not hated nearly as much. There isn't nearly such intense hate. So somehow, whatever the magic spell is, it keeps that hate against the Nazis. I don't know what it's like in America, but there's the feeling that it might reappear at any moment, and that you've got to keep a lookout for anyone who might be a Nazi. And that is useful for a politician who wants to start the next war, because they can manipulate your deep fears. You may think, well, why can't we spend the money on something a bit more interesting or entertaining, like health or education? Why do you want to spend it on war? The Holocaust does that because at its core is nightmare horror. The core of the belief is the nightmare horror delusion that all the world has to believe in. That has the effect of destroying people's belief in the innate goodness of man and replacing it with a philosophy of, who is the enemy? Who are we going to fight next? Sort of thing. And so there's that horrible manipulation, in turn helps to make sure that the worst type of people get elected as politicians.
Well, yeah, that's very good. You see, now you say it comes down. What I hear, it comes down to war making, and war making is profit and power. First, I thought if it's profitable, they want to. Why do they want to make war? Because there's more money in it. That's what it's serving. If we could get some people to understand that the Holocaust is not serving preventing bad things from happening in the future, it's serving continuing to have the worst things happening.
Yeah, it is. Totally, yeah. But that seems to be, if I can tell you, that is function. It's the supreme sacred myth of the modern world. But it also has the implication that for any politically radical person who wants to improve the world and change the world, the most important thing to do is not going on a march or shouting or whatever, but it's the perception of truth. That is the most difficult thing, and it's what we need most. People who have got insight can see what is real and can see through the illusions and the hype that are given, and demand real education, which can look at the people responsible for starting the wars and the untruths that they generate. You know, we need people, need kids to be taught how the wars are started through people drumming up these horrible illusions and hate images. And the Holocaust is a kind of supreme example of that. Although it was, it was produced retrospectively at the end of the war, with a purpose that the victorious Allies could walk away with a moral high ground. You know, they didn't have to say, oh no, look, we just dropped 2 million tons of bombs on Central Europe, mainly Germany. This is the greatest crime ever conceived by the mind of man. They didn't have to say that. They could just miss that out. Mm-hmm. We don't need to mention that. And then have this Nuremberg trial, which is an outrageous travesty of justice. I mean, a lot of people are just realizing now, all my life, I was brought up, Nuremberg was some great post-war operation of justice. And we weren't told that the Nazis were all tortured and had their testicles smashed in and everything in order to make them confess to something which never existed. We weren't told that, you know. And especially we weren't told that at the time when this alleged fake Holocaust was being narrated at Nuremberg about German death camps, the real death camp was actually being managed by Eisenhower, with over 1 million German soldiers who had surrendered, and they were out in fields without any food or shelter, left to die, deliberately left to die. And that was the real death camp, wasn't it?
Yes, and you know, they were totally perplexed. I mean, they couldn't even, those men who that was done to, they couldn't get their minds around it. They couldn't understand why this was happening. They had wanted to come west so that they wouldn't have to surrender to the Russians, to the Soviets,
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah.
You know, they never, Germans, even the higher ups, never expected the treatment that they got from the Allies. It was worse than they would have even dreamed of. So it was quite amazing. These people in these Rhineland camps were just shocked, you know, that nobody was going to bring them any food, and that the rains came down, and this happened, and that, and they were dying, and nobody did anything about it.
No. In fact, they prevented it.
They did prevent it, because people wanted to do something. And so here you have, just what, you know, I'll just reiterate this real quickly, that you have this, like you said, it was at the end of it, at the end of the war, that they really put this whole thing together. It may have just kept growing as they were going along. But they did it to cover up their own crimes and not have to be culpable, and to blame it all on the Germans and make the Germans out to be so bad that nobody would really complain about it. Well, they deserve it. And that's what so many people believe today.
They do, yeah. And it's just amazing that when that monster untruth has been concocted at Nuremberg, that this death camp was actually there at the same time. Which didn't need to be talked about. Of course, that didn't need to be talked about. That wasn't on the agenda. Just as bombing and incinerating the middle European cities was not on the agenda. And instead, you got this bogus story that they would just show a can of Zyklon, right, at Nuremberg. And just showing a can of Zyklon, for me, this is the most amazing thing, could indicate a lethal meaning, you know, that indicated fiendish intention to exterminate people. And there was nobody around to say, hang on, we just use that, just as it says on the tin, just as we're supposed to use it, for de-lousing mattresses. That's what, and it saved lives. It didn't take them, it saved lives. That wasn't on the agenda at Nuremberg. That was somehow blocked out. So it means that post-war we entered into a very extraordinary culture of untruth, culture based on untruth, in which official fabricated lies were, had this enormous meaning or enormous influence.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your book, Breaking the Spell, Nick. And I think you're right that we are making progress, that things will move in the right direction, and truth will be accepted by more and more people. And
we've got to believe that, haven't we? We've got to believe that.
Well,
yeah.
We do, and you are a very good writer, and so this book is just extremely welcome. And I just recommend that people buy it and read it and keep it and pass it on and encourage other people to read it, because it's very, very readable and it's very clear.
Oh, thanks, Caroline. Yeah, thanks for the encouragement.
You've done a great job.
Okay.
Okay, Nick, I want to thank you again very much, and I'm sure the audience is thanking you too.
Well, it's very, very, it's great to talk with you, Caroline, and hope to come back again sometime.
All right, very good. We will do it again and further work out these issues. That was Nick Kohlerstrom, ladies and gentlemen, the author of Breaking the Spell. And this has been the Heretics Hour on Monday, May 4th, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I will see you next week when I will be having another author of a new book. This is Warren B. Routledge, who has written a new unauthorized biography of Elie Wiesel. So you can imagine that he and I will have a lot to talk about. I hope to see you then, and until then, good night.